At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
It's The Wonky Show. We talk NDAs, get on the Polar Express, union societies on the law, and a 3D story has popped up. It's all coming up.
I just don't understand why, in this wonderful country we share, acronyms have to be turned into words that aren't words. You know, I come from a place, the United States, where CIA and FBI, we call these things this kind of stuff. Here, you got to pronounce things as these kind of weird word things.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your direct way into higher education, policy, people and politics. I'm your host, Rachel Firth, and here to raft down the white water of higher education policy. As usual, we have three superb guests. In London, we have Sian Waring, Chief Operating Officer and Deputy Vice Chancellor Education at London South Bank University. Sian, give us your highlight of the week.
Hi, Rachel. I was out and about this week in Manchester and Exeter at two conferences and seeing contrasting campuses and hearing all about the AUA and learning development.
And in Durham, we have Tom Brooks, Professor of Law and Government and the Dean of Durham Law School.
Well, the highlight for me this week, I suppose, as a Dean of a law school, was the news about universities facing the criticisms over gagging orders and how prevalent they appear to have been over the last few years. So that caught my attention.
And in Wonky HQ, we have Wonky's Associate Editor, David Kernahan.
Well, I think this week's had a real end of term feeling. I mean, both in terms of our national news, we seem to have stopped obsessing about Brexit for at least a week, which has been so refreshing. And it's the end of term at Wonky, of course. There'll be no daily or Monday briefings until the back end of next week. So Mark Leach has let us bring some games in, and we don't have to wear uniform today, so that's lovely.
This week, we kick off with an investigation by the BBC, which revealed UK universities have spent about £87 million on payoffs to staff that come with non-disclosure agreements, or NDAs.
Okay, so I'm going to try and take an impersonal view, as if I worked outside an organisation, but was giving an overview based on what I may have heard. But this shouldn't be taken as relating to any organisation I have worked for in the past or work for now. The anxiety about this report was that that victims of misconduct in higher education are being silenced. And I think particularly in the context where we know that more BME staff bring grievances, that there are all sorts of dimensions to that, which would be unfortunate if they were true. There's a question about how common it is, and there's a question about how much has been spent on it. So the BBC sent a Freedom of Information request to 136 UK universities and asked how much they'd paid on settlements that included gagging clauses. And what it revealed was that 96 universities have spent £87 million on about 4,000 settlements over the last couple of years. My perspective is that it's not that uncommon when people leave as a result not of directly their own choice to go on to another opportunity, job or other stage of their life. I guess I'm not that surprised to see how much has been spent. And I think there's a great variety of reasons for why these contracts are put in place. So I'm not sure you can conclude from the overall figures exactly what's been going on. But I do recognise those questions about, is it possible that there are some practices going on underneath that that collectively we'd like to know more about?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that for many people who work at universities, many academics, students, others, and also I think the public perception of universities have traditionally been as something different from a private company, that they have a different standard than a private company out to make profit and eat what it can kill, so to speak, in terms of its income, revenue, etc. And I think what's been disturbing in overall without getting into any particular cases, is seeing a rise like this, seeing that they are happening in their thousands at 96 universities, seeing the millions of pounds spent on these deals will kind of shake some of that faith that universities, you know, are something different from your typical out for themselves private company, consumed by their reputation for commercial and related types of reasons. Of course, there might be looking at the particular cases. One of the things that's true with most kind of legal settlements, there may well be some good reasons on all sides for some of these things happening. And as an NDA, these would be things that wouldn't just be agreed by one side. They'd be agreed by both sides, to be fair. But all that said, I think it is an alarming rise, a big change in higher education. I would have expected. I don't know what the data is here. I don't know if DK's got some graph nearby that he can whip out to enlighten us. I'm sure we would be enlightened. But I would have thought this is a world away from where we would have been, not just 10 or 20 years ago, but maybe 5 years ago. And a worrying change.
Yeah. I've just got my little calculator out, and I think that's an average of nearly £22,000 per person per non-disclosure agreement.
That feels high. I think there's going to be some outliers there, isn't there?
Well, actually, what I was going to say is we have been in contraction now as a sector for a couple of years. There have been a lot of staffing reductions across the sector. Some of those have been achieved quite quickly to maintain surpluses that have been successfully retained. We know that in 25% of institutions, they declared a deficit last year. I'm not surprised to see these reductions. I think it is a different climate. And I actually don't think that the amount is that great, given that it's people might be getting 3 months gardening leave plus 3 months pay in lieu of notice. So I don't think it's that high, and I don't think it's that surprising.
I kind of want to separate this out into two separate issues, because I think we're in danger of conflating two things. The first is extra contractual or contractual payments to people that are leaving their employment, possibly through no choice of their own. I think this is a marvelous thing. I think the idea of actually giving people money to compensate them for loss of earnings and to help them sustain themselves until they get the next job, I can't fault that. Somebody who believes in the welfare of staff. The non-disclosures agreements are sometimes, but not always, attached to these kind of settlement payments. They are designed, I believe, and probably Tom will correct me on this, to ensure that a former employee will not come back with an employment law case, which will take serious time and serious money to argue against and also possibly get some press. That last point prompts me to wonder exactly how enforceable these agreements actually are. If a former employee decides to speak out about the place that they work, is that university really going to pursue them through the courts for the repayment of the money? I know personally of a few cases where if a member of staff going through this process, which is a stressful process, has got a really sharp employment lawyer on these sites, on their side, that these gagging clauses can very, very easily be abandoned. They're a standard part of the process and can be argued against. If I could close with a little bit of advice, if you are going through this process, there is a legal requirement that your institution or other employer provides you with funds to engage a lawyer. Please do not go to your local lawyer, your family lawyer, or the lawyer that helped you buy your house. Please go to a specialist employment lawyer. The institution will pay for it, and it will make a big, big difference to your well-being.
Well, I think, you know, on the one hand, you have the government saying things like it doesn't want the public sector having NDAs, that it champions whistleblowers, there shouldn't be penalties for this, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they also don't like no platforming at universities, they want freedom of speech, and all the rest of that jazz. At the same time, you've got 4,000 different settlements that yes, might give a bit of gardening leave to people, but at the same time, enforce their shutting up about problems that are potentially problems in the background that the university doesn't want others to know about. And I think that's an issue.
Okie dokie, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
My name's Chris Butler. I'm a PhD student at the University of Manchester, and I research how UK governments respond to public opinion. And one of the cases I've been looking at is the Liberal Democrat U-turn on tuition fees in 2010, and I've been trying to understand how they weighed up the different policy options and how they anticipated the electoral reaction to those options. And I think it offers a couple of lessons for the current Conservative government and how they respond to the Augar review in higher education funding, which we're expecting to be published within the next few weeks or months. In particular, just as how the Liberal Democrats under-anticipated the electoral backlash to their U-turn on tuition fees on the basis of how the Blair government had got away with their U-turn on tuition fees, I think the Conservatives may be more sensitive to the electoral reaction to the position they take on student fees from the Liberal Democrats being the most recent example of government responding or changing their position on higher education. In fact, the Conservatives have traditionally polled very poorly among students, and I don't think there is much scope for them to get an electoral benefit from cutting or abolishing tuition fees. And the other thing I talk about in more detail is how the graduate tax option may actually provide a way to retain funding to higher education, which I think is of enormous policy benefit for the UK economy, but also actually avoid some of the political pitfalls around the language of tuition fees.
I'm Dr. Alison Fels, and I work in QAA's Standards and Frameworks team. My piece for Wonky this week reintroduces you to one of QAA's best-kept secrets, subject benchmark statements. Over 80 statements that cover subject areas from accounting to youth and community work. They describe the nature of study, the academic standards expected of graduates in each subject area, and what graduates might reasonably be expected to know, do and understand. We're running a project to review and revise the full set of subject benchmark statements, and we need the support of academic subject communities to do this. The statements will become part of our advice and guidance and will not have regulatory force as they did in the previous code. I also explore the implications for QAA's move to a new membership model for QAA published guidance like subject benchmarks. Are they a public good, or do the members that fund our non-regulatory work expect exclusive access?
Next up, Chris Skidmore, in an unexpectedly candid tweet, has revealed that he is keen to see the replacement of polar as a metric for measuring widening participation. So, DK, as you are the metric man and you come from round our way, what do you say?
What do I say? I say that the arguments against polar, which has existed from 2006 as a way of talking about the participation of people in higher education that are domiciled in a particular small area, are widespread and many. He's hardly kind of pushing against the tide here or surprising people. The slight surprise was that polar does form a part of the massive data drop that the Office for Students did on access and participation to help institutions make their access and participation plans that need to be submitted by the end of next month. His move against polar is probably the right one, although polar is kind of very specific in what it actually measures. Polar is just a measure of participation. It doesn't pretend to do anything else, but participation often correlates with other measures of what they like to call deprivation. So it's kind of in recent years, it is merged into people talking about the most and least advantaged areas when referring to polar quintiles, and that's not quite correct. Now, Justin Greening this week, she said that social mobility should be the primary mission of higher education, an argument with which I have quite a lot of sympathy. But she also, Chris Skidmore's intervention, I think, needs to be seen in terms of that if we are going to get serious about social mobility, we need to have better quality data. And I would also point people to the access and participation data that I have slaved over for 3 weeks to put a usable set of visualizations on the site for you to play with. And I would like to put on record that there is no way that the Office for Students should have released that amount of data in that format. It is really hard to work with. So lots of points there for you to come on.
Well, actually, really glad to see that. Certainly as a London-based university with a lot of our students from London, we know that POLA is wildly inaccurate, doesn't give a good account of students living in areas that partly been gentrified. So we've got very wealthy areas, cheek by jowl, to areas where there are a lot of markers of deprivation, such as free school lunches. And I think that point about social mobility is absolutely key here, because I think a lot of the debates around too many students going into higher education have got a class base for them. It's the idea that other people's children won't go to higher education. I think the assumption is of the proponents of so-called too many students into higher education, I think there's always an assumption that their children will go. And I think that the importance of getting this data right is that we will see the impact of government policies to widen or reduce access into HE. And just while I'm on it, I just love wonky data. And I think it's really important that we have this data and we make better informed decisions off the basis of data-informed decisions.
Tom, do you have a take on this?
Well, my only take would be, well, I suppose two things. One is I would reiterate support for moving for the tweet, as it were. I've got sympathy for the tweet. I also am a big fan of the wonky data, which is a lot better than what I get from the government. At least it's digested for me. So deeply appreciate that. Well, you're very welcome, DK, and that it's heartfelt. The only comment I'd have, I suppose, about this would be a comment about wanting participation in general. Of course, you know, we are all very committed to opening access to students from all backgrounds, especially those from lower participation neighborhoods and others. But I think that when I think about widening participation, I suppose I would like to think of it kind of more widely in terms of not just the participation of people having access to getting a university education and the benefits that does give them, but also participation more widely in communities, and wish that was something that was taken as seriously as access of students. So in terms of widening the participation of a community, I think is something. But you know, that's data for another day.
I'd like to make a plea as well around this, that we get a better acronym next time. So nobody understands what POLA stands for. Let's have an acronym which is either more interesting or maybe is just clearer.
I just don't understand why, in this wonderful country we share, acronyms have to be turned into words that aren't words. You know, I come from a place in the United States where CIA and FBI, we call these things this kind of stuff. Here, you got to pronounce things as these kind of weird word things. And it's like you hear it the first time and you think, hang on a second, maybe American English isn't, you know, real English or the original one and et cetera. I've heard it all, believe me. I've heard it all. But then I hear, you know, well, Hefke says this about the kef and the tef and the ref. I was like, what? You know, what is this? You know, what language are you guys speak? You know, anyway. Off my soapbox.
I think you make a fair point there, but can I point you to the USA Freedom Act, that was an actual acronym that somebody came up with because they clearly had nothing better to do? That was a particular highlight in this kind of thing. In terms of POLA, POLA stands for Participation of Local Areas, which is something I had to look up. So I think it would do
POLA.
Yes, Polar, if you want. I think it would maybe do us good to just go through a couple of the arguments against Polar that data people make. The first is that the resolution is low. An area, it is the, or at least used to be, the mid-level super output areas, which hopefully none of you will have a clue what they are, but I do because I had to map the bloody things. They're quite big areas. They're not quite as big as local authorities, but they are bigger than electoral wards, and they can hide a lot of difference within them. So an area that is POLA 5 can have pockets that would, if you had a higher resolution, it would be POLA 1. The second concern I have, and this is something we get with a lot of data at the moment and something I will be talking about at the Student Records Conference next week, is kind of the astrology of data. We split it into 5 quintiles. There's nothing particularly magical about the boundaries of those quintiles. So it is difficult to argue that we should tweet that we should treat an area that has a 19% participation rate as being substantially different as one that has a 21% participation rate, especially given the likely size of the error. But we do. We split these into a polar 1 and polar 2, and all of the targets are around polar 1. I think, as to go back to Sean's point earlier, that if we are going to do widening participation properly, we need to think about the individual backgrounds of students and their individual stories, rather than lumping them into one of five astrological categories.
Now, every week this season on the podcast, we are delving deep into the sector's past to uncover stories of how things were and how things came to be. With Nottingham Trent's Academic Registrar Mike Ratcliffe, here is the last in the series of Hidden History of HE.
The English didn't use state power to set up universities. It's one of the curious things that very few occasions have the English actually used state power to set up a university. They've always bubbled up through local endeavour or through benevolence. But there is an occasion, or two key occasions, when the English have used state authority to set up universities. But they're both in Ireland. So, although there was an abortive attempt to set up a university in Dublin in the Middle Ages, the key occasion comes when Elizabeth accedes to a set of rules that you know, it would be a good idea to have a Protestant university in Dublin. And the reason for that is set out in her charter to that. The idea is that knowledge and civility might be increased by the instruction of our people there, whereof many have usually heretofore used to travel into France, Italy and Spain to get learning in such foreign universities. And this is the reason why they want to have their own university, because they have been infected with popery and other ill qualities and so become evil subjects. So Trinity College Dublin is set up with the idea of stopping the Irish becoming evil subjects. Now, I'm not sure how that goes necessarily, but it becomes a Protestant bastion, and therefore they continue on that way, shunned by the Catholics. The Irish bishops refuse to let their students go there, and so there's a gap in terms of education available to people in Ireland. And this all comes to a head in 1845, where two different but very contentious government acts take place. The first is that Robert Peel decides to extend the amount of money he's going to award to Maynooth College. So Maynooth College is a Catholic seminary. It's now developed into a multifunctional university. But the notion of giving state money to train Catholic priests is an anathema. Seriously splits the government, causes huge rows. The pamphleteers go crazy. There are long debates in Parliament about it. But it really comes to the heart of should the government be supporting Catholics? And there's a lot of rather nasty business. And Peel describes the clamour against the Maynooth Bill as the most senseless and atrocious display of calumny, hatred, bigotry and bad feeling which ever disgraced any country. Obviously he didn't have to deal with Brexit, but there we go. So there's a sense of the disgrace, the real problem about setting up money to educate Catholics. The other thing he tries in 1845 is to set up a range of government-run colleges. So these, which he has the idea that they'll be set up around the country, there's a bit of a clamour as to which towns get them on, but eventually they're set up in Cork, Galway and Belfast. These are godless colleges in the model of University College London. There's no religious instruction allowed in them. They're very clear that they've got to be done. There's a weird moment that all of the architects chosen all copy Oxford buildings in order to build them. Queen's in particular gets a copy of Magdalen College Tower, so they build them in a very Oxford kind of a way. But there's still a problem that because they're now godless colleges, they're not teaching religion, the Irish Catholics still refuse to send their students to these institutions. So you end up with this problem that there's now disagreement as to whether or not an Irish Catholic student could go to a university and be taught by a Protestant, and vice versa. So there's this, you couldn't possibly talk about it. Peel again comes to this point that, how can this be sensible? How can we say that it would be sensible for us to object to an anatomy being taught by Roman Catholics to Protestants or vice versa? What a strange situation that is. The Irish bishops are sufficiently concerned by this, that they decide to set up their own university. So what they do is sensibly invite John Henry Newman to come across. He comes across to start the Catholic University in Ireland as a small outfit to do that. And the key reason this is important is he gives some lectures to explain why it would be a good idea to have a classical education. And they form the basis of the idea of the university, which is still one of the classic foundations. So this system continues. There's a federal university that looks after the three colleges. It mutates into a royal university, which allows religious heritage institutions in 1880 to join it. So that allows the Catholic University in Maynooth and McGee College in Derry to join. And it moves on that way. And interestingly, the Irish still have that system. The National University of Ireland is the inheritor of that colonial act in 1845 to try and bring higher education across Ireland. Queen's obviously separates out at the beginning of the 20th century, but it's a foundation that they still have that federal system because of Robert Peel.
Next up, we talk about legalities and groups affiliating with student unions. But before we get into that, I want to tell you about our new Wonky Plus subscription, giving you even more essential HE policy insight and access to extra wonky benefits. Along with the Wonky Daily delivered to your inbox at 8 a.m. every day, you'll get access to the Termly Wonky Briefing and Horizon Scan and Sense Check about everything happening in HE policy, ideal for those who can't follow every twist and daily turn. And as a Plus subscriber, you get exclusive free access to our monthly event, Wonky Live, so you can keep up to date on all the moving and shaking in HE policy in person with Team Wonky and experts from across the sector. You get free use of the Wonky Jobs Board, plus everyone from your organisation gets discounted rates on Wonky events and early access to tickets, including Wonkfest, which always sells out quickly. For more information, contact us on briefing@wonky.com, that's briefing@wonky.com, or visit the website at wonky.com/plus. An abortion group is taking legal action against the University of Aberdeen. They argue that the refusal of the university's Students' Association to grant their affiliation amounts to discrimination. So, Tom, as a professor of law and a dean of a law school, it would be great to get your take on this.
Yes, yeah, so this group was one that wanted to become a student group associated at the University of Aberdeen. It made its application. It was refused, and it's taking this legal action. And lots of concerns expressed about what the group wants to do, although it's the person who's put himself forward to be its leader notes that, you know, they would not be, you know, while they would be wanting to protest various places that would be, having the abortion services, that they wouldn't be the kinds of signs you might see in some kind of extreme things in the U.S. and was, you know, very much a kind of a peaceful kind of operation, as it were. One thing to kind of note about this is there was apparently something not dissimilar happening not all that long ago, also in Scotland at Glasgow, where a similar type of group was denied the ability to become affiliated to the student union and took legal action, and that was reversed. And they're allowed to be a group. You know, my view is with this is that it's truly protected free speech. There's nothing illegal about having a view that there should be a change in the law, even if one thinks that that view is mistaken and would not want to join the group. And I think that, you know, they don't have any right to having any members or being particularly popular or the rest of it or getting very far with their aims. But I think that given that there isn't that the speech is surely protected, I think that it should probably not have been refused should be allowed to continue. Again, notwithstanding whether or not, say nothing about the group's views itself.
This kind of surprised me a bit because there is an interesting precedent. I'd say nearly every UK university will have a Catholic society. Nearly every university will have a Christian union. Now, kind of both of those groups, the Catholic Church, you couldn't quite call a group, but it's a thing. And the group behind a lot of the Christian unions in the UK do have a position against abortion. And I do recall instances of student groups with those kinds of backgrounds campaigning against the right to abortion. Now, it does seem odd that you would affiliate two religious societies that would potentially hold those views and protect and potentially act on them. I should say, obviously, I mean, not all Catholics and not all Christians would necessarily subscribe to these views, but they are, in some cases, official positions. But you would not affiliate a group that explicitly holds that position. I mean, I obviously think it is a terrible position to hold. It would not be a group I imagine most of the people I know would be interested in joining. In terms of non-sports societies and affiliation, there are a lot of societies around universities that choose not to affiliate to students' unions for ideological reasons. Again, there's a couple of Christian groups I know of that don't want to affiliate because of the requirement to democracy. I mean, I actually know of groups in which they prefer to choose their society leaders via the direct action of the Holy Spirit rather than an actual vote, which a number of student unions don't like. I feel like the choice to affiliate holds for me elements of them trying to make a point about free speech rather than them actually seeking the benefits of affiliation. I mean, it's a very, very complicated one, a very complicated issue.
I had a question about whether affiliation was the same as supporting or not supporting free speech, because I wondered if the student union had criteria for affiliation, which was maybe about other activities that organisations undertake. So the Catholic Church does a lot of things apart from being anti-abortion. So I wondered if in those cases the student union was that affiliation brought other benefits, and the student union was within their rights to give or not give those benefits, and that was not the same thing as supporting or denying free speech. So again, I wondered, back to the earlier point about conflating different things, if what's going on here is two different things are being conflated.
Well, there can't be discrimination on grounds of religion. I think that would be aware. And also, it's worth noting that it's not just the Catholic Church or certain groups of Christians that have anti-abortion views. I note this being, you know, rabidly anti-abortion groups myself. I advise the Labour Party, for crying out loud. I'm very anti this view. I wouldn't want to join the group in 100 million years. All that said, I take that point. There might be some local reasons. I think that's a fair point. There might be some local reasons as to the particular way they view the how affiliation status is granted or not, but I suspect that ultimately this is going to lead to the group being allowed to be recognized, and I think it'll happen sooner rather than later.
So I have direct experience of this. As a student, I was the president of a university Catholic society in the late 90s. I should add that I was not a Catholic. I was just the last one standing in the bar when the decision was made. My one and only act as president was to disaffiliate from the students' union. The reason I did this was the same reason anybody else disaffiliates from a students' union, which is broadly we had to pay them a lot of money, and we really didn't get anything that was of direct benefit to us as a society in return. That makes me think that affiliation is potentially a double-edged sword for the non-sports societies, and I think it might be a choice. Again, as I said earlier,
societies. Is that something to do with being Catholics? The nun sports societies. Is this like?
I enjoy both your mental image and the pun, but no, it's not the case. Sports societies, from my admittedly kind of limited and long
societies too, and monkey societies for equality reasons.
Sean, you are a disruptive element here.
I like the idea of you walking into the Welcome Week and the Freshers' Fair. There's two sports hall. One is for the kind of sports, and the other is like non-sports. And you just walk in, and it is just non-sport. Now it's time for Yes, But Does It Correlate? And here, live to set this week's correlation question, it's Wonky's associate editor.
Thank you, Rachel. This week's question is deceptively simple. Does the number of students studying languages at an English HE provider in 2017-18 correlate with the number of students studying historical or philosophical subjects? I should clarify, this is FTE students from all domiciles and all modes of study. Yes, but does it correlate?
I say no.
I say no. I think modern languages are smaller than historical and philosophical studies.
Well, I think yes, just for no other reason apart from I said before I even read the question that I'd go for yes this week.
Yes. Yes, it does. A stunning correlation. R squared is 0.72. As to why, your guess is as good as mine. The Open University has been excluded from the graph as an outlier, but otherwise all the data HESA has published is in there. As a special gift to loyal listeners, you can change the subject area on the X and the Y axis of the visualization to hunt for other correlations as you would Easter eggs. See you next time.
And finally, we finished this week with a story covered by The Times, which reported that hundreds of students with the worst A-levels are going on to get first-class degrees each year. So, DK, what do you make of this?
Well, so this story has been absolutely torn into on HE Twitter. People have been really up in arms about this, and on the face of it, you can see why. So, here's universities taking students that might not have had the chance to meet their full academic potential in the compulsory sector and then taking them through university to the extent that they get a first-class degree. Now, you would say on the face of it, that is marvellous. The argument I think the Times were making, and it's often difficult to tell with the Times precisely what argument they are making, is that obviously, it's an issue with dumbing down because students that don't do very well at A level do very well at degree level. The very obvious counter argument is, university study is a different species of thing. Students study in a different way and for different purposes. And that we already know A levels are not a spectacular predictor of success at university. Anyway, there are lots of academics that, in response to this tweet, said, "Well, actually, I only got three Ds at A level."
Well, so I suppose when it comes to things about standards, I mean, the argument that there is grade inflation or claims about that have been are not unique to this country. They happen elsewhere, and I think as someone who's from the United States, I've lived in the United Kingdom for about 20 years and a citizen here too now. But looking at this with American eyes and hearing this talk about grade inflation, I have a bit of a different perspective. You know, where I come from, a professor or even a adjunct professor gives a grade in a class, and that grade stands. And they don't need to have it moderated by everyone in their office. They don't need to have their exam checked by a team. They don't need external examiners signing off on things, people from experts from other universities or indeed universities in other countries. It's here. We have, you know, our module marks are checked by everybody else. Our exam questions are scrutinized. Our external examiners sign off on stuff. And maybe these things are problems and maybe we shouldn't have them. I think we shouldn't have them. I don't like them myself. But you've got all that kind of stuff. And then a minister doesn't like hey, look, there's more first classes happening now than there were in my day. Must be a problem. I just really, it makes my skin crawl. Is there great inflation? You know, possibly, I don't know. I'll leave it to DK to tell us more about evidence for and against. I'm not a statistician, and I don't try to be. But I think that, in terms of the standards and quality assurance, I mean, an American perspective would be a lot of people here don't seem to be trusted to mark things by themselves. There's this constant checking by others, and it's like, how much more does someone want? There, that's my thought.
Yeah. Sean?
Oh, well, I just love this story. But first of all, I looked at the numbers, and the number of students graduating in the year that they were looking at, 2017, who had 3 Ds or lower at entry, was 4%. So in terms of that debate, are too many students going to HU shouldn't be there. That's 4% out of quarter of a million students. So won't make that much difference. The number of those with 3 Ds or lower who got first was less than 1% of the graduating students. But what I really loved about this story was it was absolutely about a developmental mindset that people develop at different rates. As you say, they respond to different disciplines and different teaching styles. And we have different stages in our lives. So lots of those stories were about people who'd had really rough teenage years or had left abusive families. And then they had flowered in higher education where they were supported by staff who got them and wanted their development. And as you said, went on to careers with earning potential, with increased confidence, with increased life satisfaction and improved mental health. So all the things that the Times really cares about. And what I loved about this was every single tweet was this glorious success story. And so rarely does the higher education sector manage to tell a really powerful story about what we achieve with a single voice. And this was over and over again. And the Times journalists had to kind of apologise and say, those were great stories, thank you. Because in the end, they had nothing to come back with. They just had to accept that people's lives are changed by higher education, and that's a great thing.
So that is about it for this week. Remember to delve deeper into anything we've discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes. And don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show via iTunes or your favourite Android podcast directory. Or you can find the feed that you need on wonky.com/podcast. And if you fancy appearing as a guest on The Wonky Show, do drop us an email on team@wonky.com and we'll be in touch. So thanks to Sean and to Tom and to DK and everyone at Team Wonky for making it happen. And until next week, stay first class.